Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis, Marvin Gowan, and Chuck Thurston. Hi, guys. Hey, brothers.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Paula.
Hi, sister. Good to see you, Paula.
Yeah.
Marvin.
Yeah.
Chuck. Yep, yep.
Yay, we're all here starting a new study. I'm excited about this. I was sorry to miss the last of our Divine Mother study. That, you know, that worked out not for me, but it was a good time because my daughter got married that weekend in Boulder, so I didn't have any choice, and I wouldn't have had any choice. I mean, it wouldn't even be a choice for me. Of course, I was going to
be
married.
Well, you were busy.
I got to officiate my daughter's wedding, so that was very special.
Oh, wow.
For me.
Yeah, you were busy being a divine mother while we were talking about it.
That was amazing. That was a gold star in my memory book. So I was sorry to miss that last, you know, chapter because we had such a great study on the mother, but we just decided to move on to the very next paper, The Local Universe, Sons of God. And I'm looking forward to this study. And I wanted to say to you guys, Happy Father's Day to all of our friends out there listening and to the three of you. You know, you're all such wonderful fathers. So Happy Father's Day to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any reflections?
And Happy
before?
Father's Day to that Glenn guy, you know, who's
that's right.
such a wonderful father.
He is. He's our pop, you know. we love him so much. It's extraordinary, really. You guys probably know this story, but when I was 27, my first husband, my children's father, was killed in a car accident in 1982. And here I was with a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. And Glenn came into our lives, and he was only 26 when he married me. I was 28, he was 26, and he married a whole family. and I couldn't have any more children, and he said that didn't matter to him. And so he will forever be my hero when I think about what courage it took for a 26-year-old man to marry a family and be such a devoted and wonderful father to us. And then we, of course, went on to adopt our precious little May from China 13 years later. And that was, and he likes to say, you know, I've been such a father to so many, but I never actually biologically fathered anybody. And I said, well, I always tell him, well, that doesn't matter. You are a father in every sense of the word. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, first of all, I didn't really know the details of that, Paula. It's really wonderful to hear that. And shout out to Glenn, you know, if he's listening, and if not, please convey it to him. What a wonderful thing that was to do, and noble, really noble.
Yeah.
but you know, they tell us that it's being a parent, and being, whether it's a father or a mother, is a crucial experience for every ascending mortal. We don't get past the very early mansion worlds without having that experience, because it's so critical to an understanding of who we are and who we are to God and who God is to us, that it's like fundamental. But they don't say that what's critical is to biologically be a biological progenitor. What they say is it's the experience of having parental relationship to another immature, to an immature young being, which is really interesting. It's the experience that's critical, not the biology of it. So, I mean, that's an interesting but very relevant, I think, piece of information.
Yeah, it always touches my heart whenever I contemplate it. But any, I wanted you guys to maybe reflect for a minute before we start reading on just fatherhood and what it means to you.
Well, what does it mean? You know, I'll tell you what.
What
it means so many different
father?
Things. Yeah, it
well,
means so many different things.
Yeah, that's true.
Go
ahead,
that we pause. No, it's significant that we pause. Because when you asked that, not only did I not have a ready answer, it was like, where do I start? I mean, there's so much. That was my immediate reaction.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Andre.
Right. It's an overwhelming idea. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's the one thing one always has as a realization as a father is, you know, first of all, how much one loves one's children. You know, how much do I love my children? Well, it's hard to put that into words. But once you clear away that, whatever is sweet and whatever is, you know, wonderful about that, you also have the, if you're wise about it, you have the realization of all the ways in which you feel you could have done better. You know, you look and you say, you know, I didn't do that perfectly. There are all kinds of instances. It's not like there's like I feel like I botched it or anything like that. But there's that element of, boy, you know, there are so many different things that you wish you would have had the opportunity to do better. At least in my case, because the latter part of my fatherhood had to happen in the context of a divorce. And my kids were 14, 11, and 8 at the time. And that for me was nothing I had ever looked to do or hoped for or anything like that when I actually separated. And it was, I had wanted to be a father since I was a young boy. Yeah. I had that in me. You know, not every kid has that as an aspiration, but I did. And it's the kind of thing that you wonder about those things. All that to say that I'm very, very happy with the way my children have turned out the kinds of adults they've turned out to be. They're really remarkable people. We raised them to be independent. They are independent, a little too independent for, you know, an adult and aging father who would love to see them more often. But I'd rather have them be independent and living their own lives than not knowing how to navigate life. And they know very well in their own ways and feel confident about navigating life. And I know your children probably feel that way too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always...
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Marvin. No, you go.
You know, your question is such an interesting one because I don't know about you guys, but you other, you know, Chuck and Andre, I don't often pause and reflect on what fatherhood has meant to me, because life is so enveloping and there's so much going on.
Yeah.
You know, you don't pause to reflect on that often, and so it's interesting. And as I was thinking about while you were talking, Andre, I was thinking a couple of things, and it's just off the top, right? But you know, I think women are. I'm going to make a radical statement here, maybe politically incorrect. I think women are more naturally inherently altruistic than men, but by nature. I think women are affiliative. It's built into, it's baked in, you know, to their, I think their hormonal, well, whatever, their biochemistry. It's just their nature, however you understand the source of it, to be more devoted because of the maternal instinct, et cetera, that I think is instinctive more so than for men. And so it's natural, it's unquestioned, and it's a drive. And I think women can depart from it, but I think that's not that usual. It's not that customary.
Sure.
For a man, I think that kind of devotion of giving yourself so entirely in the way, which is what's demanded in parenting, it has to be something you choose. You see the ideal, you feel the calling for it, and you choose to do it because many other urges are front and center, urges of goal orientation and vocation and comp, whatever, various drives that are not as baked in for a man as they are for a woman. But I can say, and I think I'm sure Chuck and Andre would agree, there's no experience I've had in my life that has been more formative for me than the experience of being a father. Because for me, what I came to understand on a very visceral day-in, day-out level is the lesson of it being more blessed to give than to receive. That when you pour yourself, you serve somebody, you meet their needs. Sometimes when you really don't want to, you just want to go back to sleep, or you just want to be off for a day, and you're not. You're on for 20 years, you know, and you've got to give and give, give and give and give and give, and when it hurts, you know, when it's like, oh, man, do I really? And, yeah, you got to keep doing and giving and doing so graciously. And to that little child and to meet its needs and in cooperation with the mother of our children. And when you do that, it is a shaping experience. It changes you in a very profound way, I have found. And I couldn't even articulate how it's formed, but I know that it has. And it also... It ends up, for me, as I look back on it, probably being the greatest gift that God could give me is the opportunity to give myself so fully in raising our two girls, our two kids, because I became someone different as a result that I never would have been had I not gone through that experience. And I'm forever grateful for it, for that opportunity, and for the opportunity to love these two little beings when they were so small, all the way up, and as Andre said, to really look at what they had become and just feel my heart full of joy and pride and satisfaction at having been along with them for their growth journey, you know, in a parenting capacity. So it's like, wow, I think it's one of life's major gifts.
How beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Without a doubt. I mean, it is. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I could maybe add to all of that is the, or maybe to say it in different words, is that the experience of being a father is sort of opens a person up to understanding God as a father. That those two go together, and that, I mean, that's kind of why there is that parenting requirement, I think, as part of our attention.
So.
Even if it's not biological, we still have, well, definitely have the opportunity, some way or another, to have that experience. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why that's so important, I think, is because it does put us in the same position that God is in a way, in relation to us, we are in relation to our own kids. So it's a fascinating study of, you know, parental, what it means to be a parent, obviously. But there's a lot of interesting subtleties to it. I mean, one of the things that I noticed is, as a father, was that in contrast to some maybe earlier generations or either other experiences, I don't know, not for myself so much, but I know this goes on, where it's about control and judgment, you know, the parental role goes too far in that direction. We're just judging and controlling your kids all the time, and then of course they're gonna feel resentful about that and do the opposite. Sort of inevitable. So to me, the antidote to that tendency, I mean, sometimes you just feel like, oh my God, I gotta make my kid do this or make my kid do that or something, you know, whatever it is, might be at different stages. But kind of what I discovered along the way, that is, you know, at least the way I put it, is better to be more curious than judgmental. That's kind of how I phrased it to myself. And I, you know, part of that was recognizing that that's how God is with us. You know, there's a curiosity that the Father, our Heavenly Father, and Mother as well, are curious about us. You know, that's why they want us to be in touch. That's why they want us to, you know, have communion and be aware and offer our attention, you know, the engagement of attention with God is part of that. You know, we're curious about God and God's curious about us. And it's the same way with in a family, when it's working right, at least, I think. I mean, the kids are just naturally curious about their parents. You know, they want to be like them. They want to imitate them. You know, so learning, early growth, especially, a lot of it's imitation. You know, they talk about that in the book. You imitate what you see. And so that's a kind of a deep, profound parental responsibility. It's to offer something to imitate that's worth imitating in terms of quality of love and affection and attention and caring and all those, you know, essential qualities of parental responsibility. So, but particularly that piece about curiosity, I mean, that to me, I really love the idea that God is more curious about me than he is controlling or something like that. You know, it's like, it's sort of like where the whole concept of the will of God, how that factors into that. You know, our desire to do the will of God doesn't necessarily mean we want to be told what to do all the time, right? There's a kind of there's a subtle thing, subtle. It's like the father can see ahead, you know, he can see ahead and he knows what's best for us. But at the same time, he wants us to discover that. It's the feeling I have about it. Not that we just sort of, okay, tell me what to do next, tell me what to do next. Yeah, Jesus was never like that.
No.
No, he was, you know. He'd stay up all night trying to figure out what to do. I mean, but in the presence of the Spirit of the Father, you know, be seeking the Father's will, but it was, you could tell from everything they tell us about him, that he really labored at his own effort to figure out what the Father's will actually is or was at any given moment in his life. So that combination of the presence of this parental, the Father's present within us, but he also wants us to grow. And like you guys were saying, your kids can go out into the world on their own, right? They have enough self-mastery that they can go out into the world on their own and chart their own course. And I think that's what the Father wants for us as well.
Without a doubt.
Running to him all the time, saying, oh, what do I do now? What do I do now? What do I do now? You know, it's more a matter of like, well, figure it out, you know, and report back, you know, and I'll be with you and I'll support you, right? I don't know where I'm going with that, but part of that encouragement, I think, we feel from God is this sense of curiosity. You know, I think that's true because I noticed how powerful that is with my own kids.
Mm-hmm.
And being curious about them, they come to life, right? It's like, oh, what are you doing there?
Cool.
Whatever the moment may be, expressing curiosity and interest is a very powerful thing because it draws them out, and then they want to share because let me tell you this, right? And that even continues on as they get a little older too. That the power of curiosity is a way of expressing love, I think, different from like, oh, you're doing it wrong, or whatever.
Right.
You know what I mean? Stepping in and say, oh, well, I'll do that for you. You know, you're not doing it right, or whatever it might be.
I think that's such an important point, that it's just invaluable because the greatest gift we ever get from the Heavenly Father, from the Father of all, you know, the first source and center, is free will. And it's like wings. It's like wings to a bird. We just naturally want to exercise those wings. It's inherent in us. And yes, of course, we grow to resent anybody who tries to take that freedom of choice away. You know, and I think good parents do help. I think fathers are especially good at this, helping a kid, you know, they fall down and the father's more likely to dust you off and say, it's okay, you'll get over it, you know, go out there again and try again. You know, my dad was definitely like that. He you know, fathers are not, don't tend to be helicopter parents as much as mothers do, I think. Tend to be more that way than fathers are. They're much more, it's okay, kid, you can do this. Just, you know, get up and try again. You know?
Right.
It's just a scratch. You know.
Anyway.
And courage. Encouragement. Yeah, exactly. Use your wings. You have wings. Go, fly. You know, it's great.
Yeah.
And I want to share that Brother Dave Tucker is on the board with us. It's the first time I think this is the first time Dave Tucker has joined the show with us. So, Dave, it's so good to see you here. And he writes on the board, he says, fatherhood is the most challenging thing I've ever done because it means so much to me. It's a sacred gift, and my babies are on loan to me. I think about how often I'm not doing what I could or should. That's a lot of pressure for fathers because we have to usher in the initial relationship between them and God. We are their first glimpse of the Father based off of the relationship they have with us. I often feel remorse for my behavior and selfishness as a father, but I love my babies so much and couldn't make it here without them. But I get upset often. I'm irritable or grumpy. They deserve my best representation of the Father. Of course they do, Dave. And you know what I always notice about you, my friend and brother, when I see you on Facebook, is you always express how much you love your children. So bravo for that. That's wonderful. And, you know, I think we're only human, and it's important that we can admit that we're only human to our children. And, you know, they look up to us so much, but they also appreciate it when we admit, oh, gosh, I'm sorry, kiddo. You know, I could have done better right there. You know, forgive me. I got grumpy. But it's okay. I love you. You know, I love you. I think God brings the world to kids.
You know, I think especially for fathers to do what you just said, Paula. I remember, you know, those times when, I probably didn't apologize often enough, but there were times when I would say to my young kids, you know, sorry, I was irritable, and I love you, and I barked at you, sorry about that. And those were very powerful times, and I sense, and our kids have told us that when we sort of humbled ourselves as parents to them, it was very, very powerful for them and very affirming to them that they mattered enough for us to be that frank with them. But you know, the other thing that Dave's comment made me remember was, because I think we all feel like we fell short at times in our parenting. And what I remember is, there's no way I could have done the job that I did, which I think was reasonably adequate. I think most of us probably feel that way, but compared to the range of what kids get from parents. But I don't think I could have done that, and this is the key thing for me, without leaning on God and opening to the leading of the indwelling spirit and Jesus' help and the angels' motivations. I mean, I can't remember the number of times I said help. You know, I'm at the end of my resources, and got the help. And so I think it's a partnership with spirit, raising children well and doing a decent job. And we don't do it perfectly, but our children do sense from us our caring and our devotion, and we do it well enough, and they turn out okay. But for me, The crucial help of my spiritual partners, and most importantly, the indwelling spirit of the Father within. I can't say the number of times that I had to say, help me, please, to do this well, and got the help, you know. So
yeah,
that was the other part. That was the other part of the experience that was very formative, is it opens up the partnership with God in very, very new ways, I think.
Well, it's the hardest job any of us will ever do. So, and the reason I'm glad you guys all shared that is because, you know, and Marvin, you love to point this out, the whole universe is built on a family relationship, really. The original family, and it goes on from there. I mean, that familial devotion and love that we willingly give our children goes on in the universe. We extend it. In fact, we extend it to everybody, because we're all members of the same great family. And we're going to be talking about our big brothers in the universe. And they are
big brothers.
I've got a transition.
What's that? If you're willing to
say it ain't so.
No, really. There's one paragraph here that I'm sure you're all familiar with, but it really affected me as a parent. And it kind of ties into what you were saying, Marvin, or maybe all of you, about how we're not only parents to our kids, we're also like brothers and sisters to our kids. You know, the thing of being able to say, well, I'm sorry, I screwed up, whatever. You know, that takes you down off this parental pedestal and more, and you're like in the trenches with your kids, and we're all
right.
growing together, that kind of idea. So this is from the Marriage and Family Life paper, 84, section 720, paragraph 84:7-29, where they say, "Human," and this I think was as relevant in terms of the divine family, you know, Michael and the Mother Spirit, and these sons we're going to read about, and then all the ministering spirits and everything else. They say human society would be greatly improved if the civilized races would more generally return to the family council practices of the Andes. They did not maintain the patriarchal or autocratic form of family government. They were very brotherly and associative, free and frankly discussing every proposal and regulation of a family nature. And then this is the part that sort of sums that up, says they were ideally fraternal in all their family government. In an ideal family, filial and parental affection are both augmented by fraternal devotion.
Wow. That's a good one.
So even like with Jesus or with Michael, we looked to him as our father, but we also looked to him as our brother, right? I mean, he's our human brother. He's been human. He's been, you know. But at the same time, he also has a creator role too. So that makes him more like our father. And then, of course, he's also our friend, right? So that's almost like a triad there of relationship qualities. And I think we, as parents, whether fathers or mothers, you know, we kind of learn to appreciate that, you know, that we have a fraternal relationship, a parental relationship, and also we're just friends too, you know. And the balance of all of that can be tricky because the parental role does have responsibilities, and you can't just walk away from that. And sometimes your kids need, you know, you have to restrain them or guide them in ways that get them past some things that they may not understand, you know, and you have to be able to look ahead, kind of like the father does with us, and prepare the kids just as he prepares us. Or as Jesus prepared the apostles, you know, think about that. I mean, that
well, in that sense, Chuck,
that was
too,
very,
spiritually.
That was very fatherly. Mm-hmm.
Spiritually, we are always a brother to our children, right? Spiritually,
yeah.
We are.
Right.
Spiritually,
exactly.
We have the same
the
great
brothers in the father's family. Brothers and sisters in the father's family, yeah.
So we do. We also, and this just occurred to me when you were talking. It's like, you know, yeah, we are still a sibling in the father's family, even to our own children.
Exactly.
So spiritually, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, we play the same role as father, brother, mother, sister, you know, parent, sibling. It's great.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
you know,
in that paragraph, just one quick question for you guys. In that paragraph, they mention filial, parental, and fraternal as three different types of relating within a family. And I always forget what filial means.
It means the love that a child has for the parents.
For the parents.
Ah.
Oh, okay.
So I was actually gonna jump into that, Chuck. So go ahead, finish your point.
Okay, that's all. I just wanted to clarify the meaning of filial in that context.
If you there are three essential experiences and roles in family life. At least that occur to me, but they're the fundamental ones, right? And we don't usually think of it quite that way, but they are really represented by the three persons of the Trinity. That's why the Trinity, as the original family, is the paradigm for all relationships. Really, it's a paradise level reality that trickles on down and finds expression at every level of the cosmos. So the three experiences are the experience of being a parent, of creating and then serving and nurturing, sustaining a junior being, a created being. There's the experience of sonship, which they differentiate from the fatherhood of God in the Revelation. They talk about the experience of sonship as a separate and valuable experience. Right? That's why the parent-child relationship has two components. It has the parenting component, and it has the child relationship. It's from the child's viewpoint. And so there's the love of a parent for the child. There's the love of a child for a parent. And then there's a love of a sibling for the other siblings. And the father, obviously, is the creator love. The eternal mother son is both, right? In fact, the eternal mother son is all three, I think, because what the eternal son does is feels love for the parent, the father, feels love as a brother to the infinite spirit, and also has co-parental relationship to that infinite spirit. So it's the middle position that actually experiences all three, fatherly love, child love to the parent, and fraternal love. And it's the infinite spirit that is the created child and experiences fraternal love, and is also a creator in their own right, because the infinite spirit creates personalities, but only via the agency of the Father. And the same is true for the Son. The Son only creates other beings via the agency. The original creative prerogative of the Father flows through the Son and through the Spirit. They don't have it inherently of their own, is the implication, because that's the primary function of the first person of deity. So it's the three types of love, paternal love, filial love, and fraternal love, that go with the three persons of the deity and form the essential vectors of family relationships.
Wow.
So it's very rich, actually. And the other interesting thing is we as an order of being, and this relates to this paper we're reading, are an order of the sons of God. In other words, we as an order of beings, human beings, experience all three forms of relationship. We are parents, we are children, and we are sisters and brothers.
Good point. Thank you for that, Marvin. That was great.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and it occurs to me that different people can have problems with different types of love. You know, I mean, they might be wonderful at parental love, but not so great at, you know, filial or paternal love. That's interesting. We got to get good at all three.
That's what the universe
is asking us to do.
This idea of the family council, practices that they refer to as a form of family government, is how they describe that. And I remember Claire and I really took this paragraph to heart. And we tried to do that in our home with our kids, to have more like a family council approach to how we made decisions as a family and did things. And it really was quite liberating in a way, because that everyone has a role. Everyone's, input is valued. Everyone's perspective is honored. And then you work things out. And when you do, you feel like you're a team. You're part of a team.
Yeah.
Whether you're a child in the family or one of the parents, because there's this kind of dynamic going on that they talk about here with the family council practices, which I think is very, it's so doable. That's the thing about it. It resolves so many issues that, often come up with families where people don't know exactly how to fulfill their role sometimes, especially as parents, they try to force something to happen and isn't that wise sometimes.
They allow for the wisdom of their children, too, by doing that. And children can be very wise and very intuitive and helpful if you ask for their help. Yeah.
So this idea of freely and frankly discussing every proposal and regulation of a family nature. Yeah.
Right.
Ideally fraternal. So those are practical life skills that I'm so glad the book has pointed out.
Amazingly practical, that book.
But Jesus and the conduct of his family, with Mary and the kids, was along the same lines. So we see the same pattern with what we learn about Jesus, how he functioned as a surrogate father. And I'm sure with Adam and Eve, they would have demonstrated the same thing, if not for the whole thing going asunder. But carried that legacy. So.
Yeah, just curious if Andre's got any thoughts. Oh, you're usually quiet, Andre. What do you think about the three different kinds of love and any of your, how it relates to your experience parenting?
Yeah, you mean in the family? Yeah, I think it's a natural thing, especially as your kids are growing and they move into adulthood. You definitely see the fraternal part. I mean, the best. The best mothers I know and the best fathers I know turn into sisters and brothers of their children. They may be elder brothers, they may be elder sisters, but they turn into people that don't have to be in any kind of superior, authoritarian, or any other kind of role. And so that idea of what was just read, which is, you think back to
How many times were you able to actually practice some of those Andite family council practices? Not enough, you know, in our family, and that's largely because you had two uncooperative parents that, you know, really just didn't work together very well. We worked together well when we were traveling and when we were essentially in our spheres of, you know, work. And you know, when we'd go out and do things, but unfortunately our relationship was very fraught. And so it that did not redound well to family council practices.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I would suggest would generally get shot down. So so much for that. Well, I mean, it's
so
just the way it
worked.
Yeah.
Well,
no,
and I
just
think
the
it's
way,
probably
just life on your rancho.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I can imagine a lot of couples, you know, go through that on this planet where there just isn't there's some kind of power inequality in the relationship. And anytime there's a power inequality in a relationship like that is a sign there's not enough love. Because love will apportion the power properly, because nobody's thinking about power primarily then. In that, you want to empower a partner when you're loving with them. And if you make power the more important consideration, well, that's what wins. And, you know, there's the wonderful phrase in the Arantia book, when you choose the greater thing, the lesser is included. That's a paraphrase. I always have trouble finding that. The corollary of that truth is when you choose the lesser thing, the greater is excluded. And so it's always about power or love in a relationship. If you choose power, so much for the love. If you choose the love, all parties will be empowered.
That's profound.
Good point.
That's very profound.
Absolutely.
I mean, and you made, I mean, a very interesting conversation, Chuck. I really appreciate your sharing that passage about those different kinds of love and the family council.
Marvin, are you there? Oh, Marvin has dropped. Well, he'll be back.
We will have you back,
Marvin. We know he'll be right back.
We'll look for you.
But we should just go ahead and start reading then, and then we can let Marvin finish his point when he jumps back in. Yeah.
There he is, Marvin.
I know how these conversations go. Okay, Marvin, finish your thought real quick, and then we'll go on and we'll read.
So that we can segue, quote unquote.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, and interestingly enough, the thought I was going to share relates to segue. I mean, because the point I didn't want to lose the point that you made right at the start of your comment, Andre, which is that as we mature, we transition from being a parent to our kids to being an elder, sister, or brother, which is a lovely point and is very true in my experience. But it goes further. I think at the last stages of our lives, we transition to being the child, and our children become our parents functionally.
Lovely.
For many of us. Yeah.
Oh,
and that's a
look
that's
forward to
another
that.
Nuance. Yeah, another layer, in a sense, of these amazing, miraculous vectors of family relationship. Yeah. So, anyways, that was it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, once again, guys, happy Father's Day. Thanks for the great conversation and for answering my question. That was really wonderful. And I appreciate your points of view so much. And I think your kids are all lucky, you know. So, bravo. Your children are blessed to have you as fathers. So shall we start reading about...
Thanks for saying so. Let's read.
I've just known you all for a long time. So there you go. I think it's an opinion based on pretty substantial experience with all three of you. So Yeah, let's read about our big brothers in the universe, shall we? Who wants
sure.
to take the preamble? Maybe in
I'll
part,
be glad to take
the
this
section
one.
One too.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, it's a shorty. I'll kick us off. So the local universe, Sons of God. The Sons of God previously introduced have had a paradise origin. They are the offspring of the divine rulers of the universe domains. Of the first paradise order of sonship, the Creator Sons, there is in Nebadon only one, Michael, the universe father and sovereign. Of the second order of paradise sonship, the Avonal or Magisterial Sons, Nebadon has its full quota, 1,062. And these lesser Christs are just as effective and all-powerful in their planetary bestowals as was the Creator and Master Son on Urantia. The third order, being of Trinity origin, do not register in a local universe. But I estimate there are in Nebadon between 15 and 20,000 Trinity teacher sons, exclusive of 9,642 creature trinitized assistants of record. These paradise Danels are neither magistrates nor administrators. They are super teachers. The types of sons about to be considered are of local universe origin. They are the offspring of a paradise creator son in varied association with the complemental universe mother spirit. The following orders of local universe sonship find mention in these narratives. 1. Melchizedek sons. 2. Verondadek sons. 3. Lananadek sons. 4. Life carrier sons. Triune paradise deity functions for the creation of three orders of sonship, the Michaels, the Avonals, and the Danels. Dual deity in the local universe, the Son and the Spirit, also functions in the creation of three high orders of sons, the Verondadeks and the Lananadeks. And having achieved this threefold expression, collaborate with the next level of God the Sevenfold in the production of the versatile order of life carriers. These beings are classified with the descending sons of God, but they are a unique and original form of universe life. Their consideration will occupy the whole of the next paper. So did you catch where I have trouble with the number?
which one is it?
I might even say the numbers.
The numbers, okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, nobody's going to hazard a guess?
That's what it would
look
be.
At the numbers.
Well, there's
it would
there's
be
two
just
numbers.
A guess.
I think 1,062, 9,642, right? And there's 15
those 15
between.
Those are the two
15.
That are actually as numbers, and then the others are written out, you know, 15 and 20,000.
Right. Yeah.
Well, how's that seem to you?
Well, one thing I wondered was the 1,062, I immediately asked how many systems are there in a local universe, and I couldn't quite remember.
10,000.
Anyone remember? 10,000. Yeah.
10,000.
Okay. No. So yeah, what grabbed you on this? I mean, you have such a well developed mathematical sense, Andre. You know, to an unusual degree, I think. I think it's an innate talent, but in any case, what strikes you about this, about the numbers here?
Well, what's very interesting is that the circles of the suns on the local system, the first circle is the circle of the magisterial sun. Now, we have such a circle on Gerasim,
You know, there are seven concentric circles of the various, you know, local universe, the various universe suns. And it strikes me that if that's the case on all 10,000, then if we only have a quota, and that's our full quota of 1,062, that means that that circle of the suns is occupied with its magisterial sun in the system just only one-tenth of the time. And I realize that there's probably rotation and other things, but it's always been curious to me that there would be a whole circle of the magisterial suns and only one-tenth the number to actually be able to service those circles, that 90% of the time or more, they would be vacant. So I don't know what to think about that. What do you
think? Interesting. It occurs to me, too, that they have a lot of planets to bestow themselves on.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
The Creator Sun only has to do that once, right? But they must have to do it nonstop, pretty much.
Yeah. So I mean, the one thing that it's what this would suggest to me, I mean, the fact that they say your full quota, that's one thing. You know, the aspect that really draws my attention here is that cannot possibly be if an Avonal retires in favor of other Avonals upon doing seven bestowals, okay, seven mortal bestowals, because the Avonals only do mortal bestowals, and they only generally do seven of them. That would speak to an incredible amount of flow through of the Avonal suns, that in fact they're constantly flowing through the local universe. I mean, constantly meaning over, you know, periods probably of, you know, hundreds and thousands of years, but still that it's not a static number, and that the council of the Creator Sun, the council of the Avonals, would have to be very fluid, it would seem. But I don't know what to think about it other than that. Your thoughts?
That makes sense to me, but yeah, I can't imagine what else you could think about that.
Well, here's one thought, Andre, which may fit into this. I'm looking over and over at that paragraph, and here's what struck me, and you know, numbers are not my strong suit, so I bow to you, and I always appreciate your observations in that realm. But here's what occurs to me: you've got 1,062. The other number they mentioned is that there are in Nebidon between 15,000 and 20,000 Trinity teacher sons, and then they say exclusive of the roughly almost 10,000 creature trinitized assistants of record. So those creature trinitized assistants of record, I'm assuming, work closely with the Trinity teacher sons. Otherwise, why would they mention them in this regard? So you got a total of 1,000 plus 9,000 plus 15,000 or 20,000, and that entire group of people they refer to at the very end as they're not magistrates or administrators; they're super teachers. I think I'm reading that correctly. So you have a group of, let's say, 20 plus 10 is roughly 30,000, 31,000, 32,000 of these super teachers, with 10,000 of these worlds that you're mentioning on each system, one and one to each system. So what occurs to me is that there are certainly plenty to go around to always have these super teachers in residence, and that it's the Avonal or magisterial sons that may need to rotate a little, but they always have their juniors there running things on those worlds as well. They're never vacated for lack of any super teachers. There are plenty of them to go around. That's the I don't know. What do you think about that? That's, it's interpretive, but I could read it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it, certainly there's plenty of the other teachers to go around. It just seems to me that you're devoting a whole circle to the activities of magisterial sons on each local system. I can't imagine that if they do it on ours, they don't do it on every other local system world. It's curious to me that the magisterial son would only show up for, you know, part of the time. I mean, clearly they would be doing other things, but even then, that means that if 1,000 of them were being bestowed on various worlds, among 10 million worlds, it'd be interesting to calculate what kinds of time are involved in that,
yeah,
and what kind of flow through and all of that. I haven't done a serious study on it. It's only just piqued my curiosity, and maybe someday I'll try to do some calculation on that, you know, over the, say, 200 billion year history of the inhabitation of Nevadon. Well, it's quite curious how that actually is our full quota.
Well, but I'll just make the point once again, because I think it bears, maybe I didn't make it clearly enough. The Avenals and the Trinity Teacher Sons, the Avenal, they're referred both as that, to Avenal and Magisterial Sons. It's, I think, different names for the same basic order. And the Trinity Teacher Sons are essentially kissing cousin orders. They all fulfill almost the same function. They come down, they bestow, and they act out the end of an epical age and the inauguration of another, and so they are bestowal sons on the rare occasion for each planet of the single bestowal, but then there are repeated incarnations at the different epochs all the way along, and the Trinity Teacher Sons and the Avenals and Magisterial Sons all sort of combine in that essential mission, that function. And they are super teachers. I mean, that's an accurate term. And if you take that single function, they're very closely related orders. There are 10,000 plus of them, which is, you know, a little more than one for each system. So I actually think they probably function interchangeably, is my guess.
Mm.
And for there always to be one on the system world that you're mentioning.
Hmm.
Yeah,
that's
an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, we haven't read the reference to the circles, but it could be that they function like an embassy, and they have their whole, you know, entourage there. You say they're there,
yeah,
a tenth of the time, but it could be like an embassy on each in each system. His embassy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what occurs to me.
Yeah, as I'm looking through, and going to, you know, it's under the local system headquarters world. Paper 46, right, the circles, the squares, all that good stuff. So the first set of circles is the circles of the sons, and the circles of the sons of God, you know, though the sons of God possess a social planet of their own, one of the transition culture worlds, they also occupy these extensive domains on Gerasim, and they are extensive. They're about these circles. You know, they're probably variously sized, the different ones. The ones of the angels are, they give us the size. They're literally 1.5 times the diameter of Urantia, okay, on Gerasim. That's a big set of circles. The circles of the sons of God are probably comparable, though they don't indicate that they're, you know, the same size or anything like that. But, you know, they're either smaller or larger, whatever, but they're planet-sized circles, okay? And they say the first circle of the domain of the suns is occupied by the magisterial suns. The second circle is occupied by the Trinity teacher suns, okay? In this sacred domain of the Danals, their associates carry forward the training, and the third circle is then the Melchizedek. So then they're onto local universe sons of God. So they're all accounted for. What is interesting about what Marvin is suggesting, and I hadn't considered it before, and this, to me, I always like to underscore why it is, folks, this is my plug for study groups. This is why you study with other people. Because you can never come up with all of the ideas surrounding something on your own, and one always profits from somebody else. And the question is, do they cross over to assist, you know, when the magisterial sons, and I mean, the magisterial sons, they must have a huge staff to man, you know, to person that circle, right? I mean, to handle all those kinds of things that are preparations for magisterial missions, preparations for bestowals. They're thinking about, at this time, 619 inhabited worlds, some of which have had most or all of their magisterial missions, some that are in the middle, some that are getting ready for a bestowal mission, and so on, you know, or judicial actions. All those things that magisterial sons do. It's just like, with all of that going on, it strikes me that is wild. There's a lot they're not telling us in terms of what the nature of the staff of a magisterial son might be. And I didn't mean to go all the way down this rabbit hole, but it's actually been profitable in the sense that I think it's important for us to realize as much as they're telling us that's new, they're telling us so little to get us to think about what else must they be doing? And anyway, this eases my mind a little bit, the idea that not only might there be, you know, the Danals crossing over into the first circle from time to time to give assistance, but all the other unrevealed sons and unrevealed assistants of the magisterial sons that we might be learning about in a few short lives.
I wonder if there's visiting magisterials too, you know, from other places.
Well, the question that stands out for me here is how is it that 1,062 Avonal sons are able to provide bestowal missions for 10 million planets if each one only serves that way maximum seven times. It suggests that when they say Nevadon has its full quota, 1,062, that must be the ones that happen to be in Nevadon at the given moment.
At that time,
But they must cycle out, like you were suggesting earlier, I think. Andre, they pass through and a new batch arrives. So, anyway.
Yeah, there's something that's
quite
not
a number
said that's
of
a missing
magisterial
piece.
Sons. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, upward eventually of a trillion. You know.
Mm. Right. Mm.
But there's only a billion in the, I think, do they say in the grand universe at any one time? It's not that many. It's pretty amazing. Of magisterial sons in the grand universe, I think that's in paper 20.
Oh, okay.
Hmm. And, yeah, and anyway, I don't have any special vision into our audience, but I can sense eyes rolling into the backs of people's heads. So I'm going to drop this now.
Okay.
Well,
maybe we should go on.
Well, you know, we're now going to, you know, read about the Father Melchizedek and beyond that, the Melchizedek sons. So
There was one point in this opening section that I think is worth mentioning as we move into the consideration of these other sons, and that is in the second full paragraph there. They make a very it sort of goes by quickly, but it's interesting that these sons, they say, quote, they are the offspring of a paradise son in varied association with the complemental universe mother spirit. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, some of these orders, maybe the creator son does largely on his own. Some of them, the mother spirit does largely on their own. But they're always in association with each other. And some of them are fairly fully sort of combined beings, is my takeaway. But it's a it's a very type of creative process, and they're about to launch into some of that variation with this section on the beginning on with the father Melchizedek and then the Melchizedek sons and their world. So that's good to keep in mind. It's a varied association.
Yeah, I think with each one, it's a little different.
Yeah. You want to read it, Paula, or I can read it.
Well, I just wanted to say I was kind of struck too by the fact that they classify them as descending sons, and the light carriers. They classify the light. Am I reading that correctly? They talk about the light carriers and then classify them as descending sons. Would they classify also the Melchizedek, Ronda Dex, Lonan Dex as descending sons, or is that just the life carriers they're saying?
No, I think they all are.
You think they all are?
All
okay.
of these are, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that clarity, because I wasn't sure about that. So, I think that terminology, descending son, is unique to the Orangibox.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sons who descend from, from the centers of creation out to the outermost levels to minister is unique to the Orangibox. I've never heard that anywhere else.
It makes sense to me,
central concept. It's a central concept because as they descend, they're coming from the place we're going to. And so they become the ultimate way shower for us, because this is where they're from. They're going to show us the way back to there. That's where we're headed. We're ascending. So I love that. I like to point that out to people when I'm introducing the Orangibox, that Christ Michael is a descending son, and that all of God's children benefit from experience, either ascending or descending, and that experience is invaluable to all of us, all of creation, them showing us the way and us being shown the way. It's essential. And we, show others the way as well. So, those behind us.
The idea that we're ascending sons is kind of exciting, too.
Yeah, very exciting. Looking forward to it.
even though we're starting at the bottom.
I'm looking forward to meeting all those descending sons, and they're about to introduce us to a few of them here. So, Marvin, I'm happy to read this one. This is section one, Father Melchizedek.
And I will just interject and say it is 1 billion in the grand universe. If each of the local universes have, 1,062, if that's a full quota, that's about 700 million. Of that, that's about 70%, and that leaves about 30% to be, apportioned to Havona, which is part of the grand universe, and that would suggest that all the ones that have gone through their bestowals are in large numbers on a council on paradise, functioning somehow there, would be the explanation, because there's got to be many more than a billion that have done bestowals, let alone magisterial missions and everything else. So that's all I have to say. That's it. No more numbers.
Okay.
The rest of the program. I almost promised.
Okay. Well, we'll see how many more numbers come up. But We are, like as Marvin said, we always appreciate your mathematical prowess, Andre. It's fabulous. I admire it, so thank you. So here's section one, the Father Melchizedek. After bringing into existence the beings of personal aid, such as the bright and morning star, and other administrative personalities, in accordance with the divine purpose and creative plans of a given universe, there occurs a new form of creative union between the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit, the local universe daughter of the Infinite Spirit. The personality offspring resulting from this creative partnership is the original Melchizedek, the Father Melchizedek, that unique being who subsequently collaborates with the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit to bring into existence the entire group of that name. In the universe of Nebadon, the Father Melchizedek acts as the first executive associate of the bright and morning star. Gabriel is occupied more with universe policies, Melchizedek with practical procedures. Gabriel presides over the regularly constituted tribunals and councils of Nebadon. Melchizedek over the special, extraordinary, and emergency commissions and advisory bodies. Gabriel and the Father Melchizedek are never away from Salvington at the same time. For in Gabriel's absence, the Father Melchizedek functions as the chief executive of Nebadon. The Melchizedeks of our universe were all created within one millennial period of standard time by the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit in liaison with the Father Melchizedek. Being an order of sonship, wherein one of their own number functioned as coordinate creator, Melchizedeks are in constitution partly of self-origin and therefore candidates for the realization of a supernal type of self-government. They periodically elect their own administrative chief for a term of 7 years of standard time and otherwise function as a self-regulating order. Though the original Melchizedek does exercise certain inherent co-parental prerogatives. From time to time, this Father Melchizedek designates certain individuals of his order to function as special life carriers to the Midsonite worlds, a type of inhabited planet not heretofore revealed on Urantia. The Melchizedeks do not function extensively outside the local universe, except when they are called as witnesses in matters pending before the tribunals of the superuniverse, and when designated special ambassadors, as they sometimes are, representing one universe to another in the same superuniverse. The original or firstborn Melchizedek of each universe is always at liberty to journey to the neighboring universes or to paradise on missions having to do with the interests and duties of his order. Interesting being, our Father Melchizedek. Are you there? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're just sort of pausing. There's so much in here. You know, we're just sort of pausing. I'll make one observation. One observation right at the beginning, in the very first few words, where they say, after bringing into existence the beings of personal aid, such as the bright and morning star, other administrative personalities, they begin a new kind of liaison. And it's just interesting to me that this whole order, the Melchizedek order, they describe later on as a teaching order and also as an emergency missions. They're very versatile teachers and administrators, and they function in many, many different roles, but they're not primarily considered an order of personal aids, which is interesting. Yeah, the bright and morning star and other what they call administrative personalities. So the Melchizedeks are not primarily administrators. They're primarily teachers and very creative and capable in adaptive and emergency situations to do almost anything that are any set of needs that are unique set of needs that need to be addressed. And it's interesting that we have quite a few of the papers in the Ranch Revelation are authored by varied Melchizedeks.
By them,
yeah, and of course, and it's fascinating to think about this in terms of the summer study session as to the role of our Melchizedek, his emergency mission 2,000 years before Jesus' bestowal, Michael's bestowal, and the nature of that mission. And frankly, isn't it a Melchizedek body of Melchizedeks that had some kind of supervision responsibility over the Urantia revelation, this fifth epical revelation? I thought they did.
They must have had.
Isn't it a Melchizedek group of receivers that were given jurisdiction over this revelation, if I'm remembering correctly?
Huh. That's a great question.
For
part two, and part three, and certainly over the Midware Commission, I think there was a Melchizedek that was supervising the Midware Commission, if I'm not forgetting, incorrectly.
What I remember is that there were some kind of requests made by the United Midwares, and they set for this revelation, and I think it was the Melchizedek receivers that did, and I think they were given some kind of jurisdiction over shepherding, you know, along with the Angels of Progress and the Angels of Churches, etc., all the different cores, but they're the ones who have jurisdiction over this revelation, which, you know, arguably starts to put it in the category, as was the Melchizedek revelation, of an emergency revelation.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
A unique and adaptive revelation that really doesn't have much precedent in the rest of the local universe.
Well, Mantusha Melchizedek was over part two, over the commission of joint Nebadon personalities that is spoken of at the end of paper 56. This paper, 25 papers, or this part rather, Nebadon personalities numbering 12 and acting under the direction of Mantusha Melchizedek. So you're right, you know, in terms of being in charge of that. And similarly, in part three, there's a similar commission that oversaw that. And that was, they say there, these papers were authorized by a Nebadon commission of 12, acting under the direction of Mantusha Melchizedek, the same commission probably for parts 2 and 3. So that's all very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's
a quick
sense.
Allusion. I was just scanning the next section, and one of the things they say in paragraph 4 is these universe sons go in small groups to the worlds to serve as advisory commissions. So that would be probably related to this revelation. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I was intrigued by so much of what they said in here. And one of the things that I found very intriguing was that because this Father Melchizedek, participates in the creation of the order, that makes them uniquely self-governing. Did that strike you guys? I mean, why would that be so?
Yeah, he's co-parental. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And
that just struck me as interesting. Why? What about that makes them uniquely self-governing?
Well, it's not unique. It's any order that self participates in its own creation has the inherent
ability,
capacity to self govern. Yeah, and that includes us as mortal beings. We are a self-governing order. Mortal ascenders, when they gather, self-administer, and finalers self-administer, because we are an order that has had in its origin, has the capability to participate in co-creation.
Right,
which,
okay.
So that we share that nature with the Melchizedeks.
And they
teach us that too, right?
They one of the main things they teach is self-governance, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
They probably do. Yeah.
Which is why they train us as administrators. That's one of the things that's a big deal throughout our universe ascension is to be to administer almost every activity that along all along the way that we pass through. They teach us how to make it happen, and the implication being that we will engage in that activity in some much upstepped way in the next universe age, in the ages of outer space. That's, I think, one implication. So we are self-governing. As are the Melchizedeks, yeah.
That's a good point, yeah. That's true. And we are co-creators, too. That's interesting.
Regarding the question of the Melchizedek receivers potentially having a role in relation to the Urantia book, was that one of the questions? There's a comment here that suggests that that may not be the case. This is in, it's in the Melchizedek paper, paper 93, opening section, paragraph 2. They say that, the Melchizedek order of universe sonship has been exceedingly active on Urantia. A core of 12 served in conjunction with the life carriers. A later core of 12 became receivers for your world shortly after the Caligastia secession and continued in authority until the time of Adam and Eve. These 12 Melchizedeks returned to Urantia upon the default of Adam and Eve, and they continued thereafter as planetary receivers on down to the day when Jesus of Nazareth, as the Son of Man, became the titular planetary prince of Urantia. So when at that same time, around Pentecost or the termination of Michael's soul here, that's when the seraphic planetary government was set up, with the 12 groups of angels who taken over responsibility of the superhuman governance of the planet. So I get the impression that those 12 groups of angels kind of took over for the Melchizedek receivers.
That's interesting, Chuck. I never thought of that.
Because they continued thereafter as planetary receivers on down to the day when Jesus of Nazareth, et cetera.
And then they left. I mean, Machaventa got appointed vicegerent, right? Planetary prince.
Yes.
The 12 cores of super angels are operating on the planet. So the other 11 receivers went off to do other things. Is that the implication?
I don't know. I'm guessing. Apparently, I mean, Machiavelli is still very involved. I mean, he's on the council.
Right.
They
probably
served a term as governor general. He is going to be our planetary prince. Any day or any hour, or maybe not for long. So that at some point he's going to step into that role, and then that's going to change everything again. But
There might be this, there may be an implication in the Melchizedeks that are named. You have to wonder, why is it that they tell us, a paper was written by a Melchizedek or indicted by a Melchizedek or whatever, but sometimes it's Mantusha Melchizedek, and sometimes it's Manavanda Melchizedek, and sometimes it's the other M. Melchizedek, I forget who that is right now, but there are only four named Melchizedeks, and that's Machaventa, Manavanda, Mantusha, and the fourth one whose name escapes me right at the moment.
Is it Manavant?
Basically, what? Pardon?
Is it Manzant?
No, it's not Manzant. No, Manzant was a teacher in the post
Planetary Prince Age.
Oh, okay.
I'll find it. But any case, there's only four. I suspect that those four were all Melchizedek receivers, that's why they named them, because they were part of that troop of whom we know Maceventa was one of the 12. And so evidently four of those 12 were part of this revelatory commission in one way or the other, authors or whatever, and there are even some other Melchizedeks, unnamed, okay, that have been brought in. But evidently a third of the receivers, yeah, have had some kind of,
Manavantia.
Manavantia?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll look it up. Sorry to interrupt you, Andre.
No, that's all right. Yeah.
Now, also, I don't know where it says this, but when the day comes when Maceventa steps into his role as Vicegerent Planetary Prince and assumes the responsibilities of Planetary Prince, I think he again is going to be accompanied by a group of other Melchizedeks, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know if it would be the same ones who were functioned as the planetary receivers up to the time of Jesus.
He can do what he wants.
But yeah.
He can do whatever he wants.
Right. Well, and they also point out that in that role, he can make himself visible, which is pretty, it's going to be pretty interesting, whatever that
yeah.
comes. But he's going to have But when that day does come, it's not going to be just him. He's going to have a whole staff. He's going to have a whole, administration, I'm sure.
Yeah, we could read that section on the Melchizedeks that follows this one on the Father Melchizedeks, because it'll talk a little bit more about this, and then maybe talk about all of those aspects in context, because they all flow from one another.
Yeah,
I mean, there's something very curious in this next section about the nature of Melchizedeks, and it gets us to think outside of the box and outside of the ascendant regime as well, in terms of what else they're doing.
So should we press on?
Marvin, are you who's gonna read that next one?
We're talking about the segment on the Melchizedek sons.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I can, if you just give me a second to get back there. I was just doing some search on. I keep thinking there is a statement in there where they talk about some group, and I think it was Midwayers, putting in a petition. It was either for the Jesus Papers, but I don't think so. I think it was for the entire fifth epical revelation. There was a group that put in a petition to some higher. It might have been the Ancients of Days, might have been the Constellation Fathers, or it might have been. No, I know the one about the Urmia lectures. The Midwares petitioned to make some interpretation, but I'm talking about the entire fifth epical revelation was a result of a request at a certain point. And I think it's by a group of by the United Midwayers of Urantia, to some higher body, and it was either the Constellation Fathers or the Ancients of Days, or the Melchizedek receivers, and I couldn't find it.
I think that is apocryphal. I do. I think that was in the apocrypha.
No, I don't think it's in the apocrypha. I remember reading it recently, I'll keep looking.
Okay, all right. Okay.
But yeah, so we're in section number two then, Melchizedek sons.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Melchizedek sons. The Melchizedeks are the first order of the divine sons to approach sufficiently near the lower creature life to be able to function directly in the ministry of mortal uplift, to serve the evolutionary races without the necessity of incarnation. That's interesting. These sons are naturally,
at the midpoint of the great personality descent, by origin being just about midway between the highest divinity and the lowest creature life of will endowment. That's also really interesting. They thus become the natural intermediaries between the higher and divine levels of living existence and the lower, even the material forms of life on the evolutionary worlds. The natural intermediaries. The seraphic orders, the angels, delight to work with the Melchizedek. In fact, all forms of intelligent life find in these sons understanding friends, sympathetic teachers, and wise counselors. Wow, what a combination. Understanding friends, sympathetic teachers, and wise counselors.
The eldest in the family. I mean, isn't that,
yeah,
that's kind of the role that the eldest often plays.
The Melchizedeks are a self-governing order. With this unique group, we encounter the first attempt at self-determination, the first attempt at self-determination on the part of local universe beings, and observe the highest type of true self-government. These sons organize their own machinery for their group and home planet administration, as well as that for the six associated spheres and their tributary worlds. Is that a system level? You guys read that way?
No, that's at the local universe level.
Okay. Thanks. And it should be recorded that they have never abused their prerogatives. Not once throughout all the super universe of Orvonton have these Melchizedek sons ever betrayed their trust.
Mm.
They are the hope of every universe group which aspires to self-government. They are the pattern teachers of self-government to all the spheres of Nebadon. All orders of intelligent beings, superiors from above and subordinates from below, are wholehearted in their praise of the government of the Melchizedeks. The Melchizedek order of sonship occupies the position and assumes the responsibility of the eldest son in a large family. Most of their work is regular and somewhat routine, but much of it is voluntary and altogether self-imposed. A majority of the special assemblies, which from time to time convene on Salvington, are called on motion of the Melchizedeks. On their own initiative, these sons patrol their native universe. They maintain an autonomous organization devoted to universe intelligence. I'm thinking of David Zebedee, right? They maintain an autonomous organization devoted to universe intelligence, making periodical reports to the Creator Son, independent of all information coming up to universe headquarters through the regular agencies concerned with the routine administration of the realm. They are by nature unprejudiced observers. They have the full confidence of all classes of intelligent beings. The Melchizedek's function as a mobile and advisory, the Melchizedek's function as mobile and advisory review courts of the realms. These universe sons go in small groups to serve to the worlds to serve as advisory commissions, to take depositions, to receive suggestions, and to act as counselors, thus helping to compose the major difficulties and settle the serious differences which arise from time to time in the affairs of the evolutionary domains. These eldest sons of a universe are the chief aides of the bright and morning star in carrying out the mandates of the Creator Son. When a Melchizedek goes to a remote world in the name of Gabriel, he may, for the purposes of that particular mission, be deputized in the name of the sender, and in that event will appear on the planet of assignment with the full authority of the bright and morning star. I'm thinking of Melchizedek being assigned as vice chair and planetary prince. This sounds similar. Especially is this true on those spheres where a higher sun has not yet appeared in the likeness of the creatures of the realm. When a creator sun enters upon the bestowal career on an evolutionary world, he goes alone. But when one of his paradise brothers, an Avanol son, enters upon a bestowal, he is accompanied by the Melchizedek supporters, 12 in number, who so efficiently contribute to the success of the bestowal mission. They also support the paradise of Avanols on magisterial missions to the inhabited worlds. And in these assignments, the Melchizedeks are visible to mortal eyes, if the Avanol Sun is also thus manifest. There is no phase of planetary spiritual need to which they do not minister. They are the teachers who so often win whole worlds of advanced life to the final and full recognition of the Creator Sun and his Paradise Father. The Melchizedeks are well nigh perfect in wisdom, but they are not infallible in judgment. When detached and alone on planetary missions, they have sometimes erred in minor matters. That is, they have elected to do certain things which their supervisors did not subsequently approve. Such an error of judgment temporarily disqualifies a Melchizedek until he goes to Salvington and, in audience with the Creator Son, receives that instruction which effectively purges him of the disharmony which caused disagreement with his fellows, and then, following the correctional arrest, reinstatement to service ensues on the third day. But these minor misadaptations in Melchizedek function have rarely occurred in Nebadon. These sons are not an increasing order. Their number is stationary, although varying in each local universe. The number of Melchizedeks of record on their headquarters planet in Nebadon is upward 10 million.
So they don't give us an exact number in that case, do they?
No, but it's not much more than, seems like it's not much more than 10 million. You know, they would have, if it was significantly more, you'd think they would have mentioned that number.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because that's not much more than one Melchizedek on average per inhabited world.
Yeah.
That is an interesting correlation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although they go on to say, you know, they're clustered because they're on the teaching worlds. They have their own set of worlds. And it sounds like, despite these roving commissions that are out and around everywhere and their emergency missions, et cetera, it sounds like their function is sort of clustered primarily around the local universe headquarters, where they run the Melchizedek University.
Are you guys amazed by how much they do? I'm just like blown away by how much they do. Wow.
It's stunning. Yeah.
Well, and their their nature.
Yeah.
And there's this little comment here I think is interesting, where they say the Melchizedek Order of Sonship occupies the position and assumes the responsibility of the eldest son in a large family.
Right.
And I think that's in some ways pretty literal in the opening section where they list these four orders of descending sons, Melchizedek's, Baranadex, Ladonadex, and Life Carriers. That ordering is also the sequence of when they're brought into existence, so that the Melchizedek sons were the first to be brought into existence. So in that sense, they literally are the elder brothers, particularly of the Baranadex, Ladonadex, and Life Carriers, in some meaningful sense. And for me, where that really comes into focus is thinking about Macaventa and Caligastia, right? That not Caligastia being Ladonadex's son, that Macaventa is like his older brother. You could, literally think of it almost in those terms. And the events that, you know, that have been playing out on this world, particularly since Macaventa has become more involved, are in a sense sort of a almost like a some kind of a brother against brother struggle between Macaventa and Caligastia, contending for influence on the mortal level.
Mm.
And that Melchizedek is sort of our guy. I mean, he's so important, you know, what he's done for us since, you know, preparing for Michael's Festool, but also, you know, everything that happened in 600 BC and, the Salem missionaries and all of that. You know, that's all. He has initiated all of that and been countered in a sense by Melchizedek at every turn. I mean, by Caligastia at every turn. Macaventa is largely successful in most of what he's attempted to do, but you can see the difficulty that he was up against in carrying out because of Caligastia's opposition to Michael. You know, that Michael is sort of Caligastia's nemesis. And then you have Macaventa in the middle, you know, trying to prepare the way for Michael. But even after trying to, you know, continuing to uphold the truths that have been presented by him and by others, and especially by Jesus. So, but anyway, this older brother relationship between Macaventa and Caligastia is something I find intriguing to think about. Because of the contention, you know, it's not a peaceful relationship between the two of them at all.
Do they ever mention in their accounting of Melchizedek's sojourn on earth that Caligastia ever directly came against him in any way?
Well, you can see evidence of how he worked against what Melchizedek tried to do while he was here,
mm-hmm.
in terms of preparing the way for Jesus. That a lot of that work was, in a sense, sabotaged. You know, like the dispersion of the northern tribes in 1029 BC, who were the ones who were more directly prepared by Melchizedek to receive Jesus.
But it was after the fact, not directly while he was here.
Right. Right. They do comment that he did some things to restrain the rebel secondary midwares. I forget exactly where that is, or it was just kind of left at that. I think he held himself, you know, in a superior position. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what occurs to me.
Directly, you know, attacked him, but I think Melchizedek did after Melchizedek left.
Then he did.
As a visible presence, and all kinds of things going down. Yeah.
That's intriguing. Maybe a healthy respect there for his elder brother.
Well,
that's just interesting. Yeah.
Or a desire to sabotage the work that he did. Yeah.
What were you going to say, Andre, about that?
Well, what was I going to say? It strikes me that could easily have been the case that he was actively functioning against Melchizedek while he was incarnated, especially during that time. And of course, I mean, there's the 11 Melchizedek receivers that were still functioning on Urantia, and
probably in support of of Milk and Deck. But what struck me was how severe a case. I mean, it seems so distorted and immature. And you have to wonder what is exactly the psychology of that kind of a being doing that, that is effectively manifesting oppositional defiant disorder, you know, on a superhuman level. What is that about? My goodness gracious. Going against everything, regardless.
You know, it's an interesting question you ask, Paul. I mean, because I, in contrast to Adam and Eve, where they talk a great deal about Lucifer's and Caligastia's interference and meddling, trying to derail that mission, I don't recollect a single instance in part three where they describe the activities of Lucifer and Caligastia to derail the Melchizedek mission, which I'd never thought about that before. But you would think if they were active about it, you would think that it would have been mentioned. And it makes me wonder whether, you know, because there's quite a gap of time between the Adamic mission and the Melchizedek mission, some 35,000 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 35,000 years, 37,000 roughly from Adam and Eve to our current day, and then 4,000 years ago that Melchizedek was here. So it's it's more like 33,000 years intervening. Yeah. It's quite possible that whatever was going on with the curtailment and trial of Lucifer and all of the rebels, it's quite possible that it was a very different set of circumstances, and their ability to interfere was dramatically curtailed by that point, because it was a pretty crucial setup. And I agree with you, Andre. I mean, you see with the scribes and Pharisees, lots of opportunity for Luciferian interference, certainly. So something was going on. But but it's curious to me that there's no mention of that in relation to the Melchizedek bestowal. And then there was one other thing just before we end, you know, because we're getting to the end. Something really caught me that really tugged at my heart in this section we just read. It's the very end of the first paragraph where they say the seraphic orders, the angels, delight to work with the Melchizedek. In fact, all forms, which includes us, of intelligent life find in these sons understanding friends, sympathetic teachers, and wise counselors. And what caught me, I mean, for me, what's very helpful for me is to actually think in everyday terms about the eternal ascent. What will we be experiencing? And here I see a scenario where I get to sit down and not only have a Melchizedek brother, because there are elder brothers as well, right? They're sons of God. Not only have them be a teacher or a counselor, which is kind of a superior-subordinate relationship, but we can actually have friendships, Melchizedeks. Mm-hmm. That's just like, man, that floats my boat. I don't know about how you guys feel, but to be able to sit down and shoot the breeze with a Melchizedek and share our lives together, man, what an incredible opportunity we have. Just that one alone is like, wow, I'm so excited to have friendships with Melchizedek, you know. That's great to look forward to.
To access their wisdom. I mean, you know, what do they say about their wisdom? And here I can't find it again, but they say it's just really extraordinary wisdom that they have. And, you know, when you hear, you know, wisdom when you hear it, right? Well nigh perfect.
Yeah.
When you hear wisdom, it resonates on such a level. It's like, wow, that is so insightful and extraordinary. And it's so rare on this world, really, honestly. But when you hear it, you feel it, you know it. And so to have access to it, I mean, can't you just imagine sitting in one of their classes just completely enthralled by what they're saying? I do. I think about it. I think, wow, I want to go to those Melchizedek classes and just like sit in their front row and be enthralled by them.
Well, you know, if you kind of read between the lines, even what they tell us about Maccaventa when he was here, you know, for his set up the colony at Salem and everything. There's so many interesting little hints. Like they mentioned that the members of the family of Cottrow, with whom Melchizedek lived for more than 30 years, knew more of these higher truths, and et cetera, et cetera. But just the conviviality of that, okay, here's the family. We get to put up Melchizedek for 30 years, right?
Live that's our pretty family. Amazing. Yeah.
You know, he had this quality about him that was very appealing. And what really strikes me is how inspiring he must have been to kick off the Salem missionaries and the heroic, you know, what they did. You know, the great distances they traveled and everything they went through to spread these teachings. They were so dedicated and so determined. And somehow that was an outgrowth of the influence of Maccaventa. That his, I don't know, he just brought something out in the people that were near him that was extraordinary in terms of motivation and determination.
Right.
Love and valuing everything that he had taught them, that, you know, those teachings were so compelling that they just had to get out into the world
and share them.
Spread the good news. Yeah, right.
Who
right.
better to bring truth back to the planet, right, than this big brother who is so friendly and welcoming and approachable and who's so understanding and, you know, not, I mean, it's just really incredible to think of him in this way, and this particular section really adds to that. And I loved, I think, Marvin, you said it reminded you of David Zebedee, and that just struck me. It's like, oh my gosh, maybe David was like, maybe one of those receivers, you know, was really helping him with with intelligence, with ability, you know, because they really, the way they describe it, they were describing David Zebedee.
Yeah, the role he played.
Yeah, maybe he was sponsored by one of the Melchizedek.
They describe them as
a universe intelligence corps on special missions, you know. It's just like, that was David Zebedee all over. I mean, he had this group of messengers, and they acted as an intelligence group, you know, passing on information, strategically assessing situations, advising the master, and it's just like, that's got Melchizedek written all over it.
He's involved there somehow, you know, that
it's
he was
kind
just,
of mysterious,
you know,
how that happens. But they do say that, you know, Maccaventa continued to work with prophets and seers, you know, all down through a whole period leading up to Michael's Epistle. And then the 6th century B.C. thing. I mean, how did he do that? And they even say that we have no idea how he did that, the authors of the book. I mean, even the planetary supervisors didn't understand
comprehend. Well, a hint is that they are so able to, you know, where they have just told us, they're so able to connect with the human level.
Uh-huh.
So there's something there.
Yeah.
And then
they can make themselves visible too.
Right.
And whether they do that or not in those circumstances, I don't know. But
well, that would be quite start to wake up one night and see him standing in your room. That would be pretty amazing. I have nothing but sympathy for the shepherd that he walked in his tent.
I know.
Had to have been stunning, right?
And then how they talk later out under the stars, you know, it's just like, it's so personal. It's just so likable, so charming. So charming.
Yeah. That's a good word for it. So charming.
Yeah.
Wow.
You think about 600 BC, those teachers in particular, you know, like Lassay and Zoroaster and, you know, Gautama. It almost makes me wonder if maybe at some point, like just some little guy showed up wandering through town, look like a beggar or something. So, hey, let me explain some things. And then he disappears again. I mean, I don't know. It's just a wild imagination. But
it's possible, though.
Who knows? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they make it sound like he worked pretty directly with some of these people. And, again, how he did that, they don't really know. But it's pretty... It's interesting to think that that might still be possible, I guess, is sort of the takeaway for me from that, that he's still very much involved with the affairs of this planet. He's doing everything he can to help. So whatever he was able to do in the 6th century B.C., something like that might still be possible, even now, or in individual cases, or who knows. But I'm sure he's looking for any and all opportunities to help.
It would seem so.
So.
Especially
yeah.
as Vice-Garant Planetary Prince, right? He's
right.
taken on a much
exactly.
bigger role.
We will at some point, yeah.
Yeah.
We don't know when, but...
Well, I noticed that Vaughn would like... He has his hand up and he'd like to make a comment, so I'm going to put him on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great.
Okay, I got him.
Vaughn.
Yeah.
Okay. We have 3 minutes.
What's up, Vaughn?
I don't think he would have a beggar. I think
I
it would have been more
I was
like.
Kind of joking, okay.
joking's fine. But I took the opportunity to raise my hand because I think he would have appeared with long hair and in white robes.
Okay.
Mm. Like
maybe
the,
so.
Who knows?
Like the personality I. Had an encounter with. I'm done.
Well, once
okay.
again, though, that kind of gregarious wisdom that he exhibited, that kind of a friendly, you know, it just seems like it would be obvious no matter how he appeared. You know?
Right.
And, yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah, if he did, right. Anyway, here's to you.
Appropriate to the person he was approaching.
Right, right. And clearly he handpicked some of those students in the 6th century B.C., you know, obviously. And they made a huge difference to humanity. Yeah.
Indeed.
Well,
indeed.
Here's to our brothers, the Melchizedeks. I'm looking forward, like you guys are, to meeting them personally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. However, they
really,
want to appear.
Really looking forward to really developing some close friendships with a
yeah.
Melchizedek here or there, you know, along the way.
Yeah.
I mean, what an opportunity, you know, to sit mm-hmm. and converse and share experiences and perspectives, you know. I mean, that's very significant to me. They're not only counselors and administrators, but friends. Yeah, that's really touching.
Boy, who could expect more from a big brother, right? I mean, that's just awesome to me. Big brother is a special role. Jesus
yeah, like Jesus went down for the Passover. He would take each of the kids.
Yeah.
And he hung out with them for days, and they just talked about this, that, and the other thing. You know,
right.
that's a true friend associate, you know.
And we might point out that his first bestowal was as Melchizedek, so... you know, he has a special understanding of them, and maybe that bestowal played into his big brotherly nature somewhat. I mean, I would think it did. Yeah. Well, guys, what a great conversation. Thank you. As always, I look forward to Saturdays.
It's been fun.
I look forward to being with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, to all
yeah.
of our listeners. Thanks. Sorry, some of them were getting bounced off the board. I don't know why, just instability. But Isadora, you hung in there with us, girlfriend. Love you, darling. Love
and
all of our listeners.
And some of you will be
Thank
going to the science symposium and
right.
Enjoy that. That's there's the remaining two or three presentations there.
Yep.
So enjoy.
Enjoy. Well, thanks, you guys. Have a wonderful week. Happy Father's Day again.
Thank you, Paula, and thanks for opening that way. That was really, really
thank you, Paula.
Neat.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Until
next
you all.
Time. next week. Okay. We'll be back.
All right.
On the Melchizedek Worlds is up next. Yeah.
All righty.
It is. That's a fun one.
Yeah.
Lots to talk about there. All right.
All righty.
Talk to you soon.
Well, take care.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Love you too. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.